This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Calendar. Let's be real. Running a household can be exhausting and chaotic. And finding the perfect Mother's Day gift, it's not exactly a no-brainer. Until now. The Skylight Calendar is the best way to organize the family and give everyone, especially mom, some peace of mind to enjoy the things that matter most. The Skylight Calendar is a smart, touchscreen calendar that keeps track of and manages the chores, dinner planning, groceries, and to-dos for the whole family. The Skylight Calendar automatically syncs each family member's digital calendars and displays them all together on one color-coded touchscreen. It even doubles as a digital picture frame so you can finally share all those special moments that are just sitting on your phone. As a limited-time offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight calendar when you go to skylightcal.com/easy. That's skylightcal.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightcal.com/easy.
On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Mom and Dad Are Fighting is sponsored by Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo, the third installment in the hilarious New York Times best-selling children's book series filled with inventions, science experiments, and baseball-playing robots. By former National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, John Sheska, and mad science illustrator Brian Biggs. That's Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo, on sale now from Amulet Books. And by Prudential's 4040 Vision, a multimedia microsite exploring what life and the future looks like for today's 40-somethings. Hear what inspires real people, the hopes they have for tomorrow, and much more. See yourself in their stories at slate.com/4040vision/family. And by Little Passports. Keep your kids busy this fall with Little Passports, the award-winning subscription for kids. Right now, Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners can save 40% on their first month with the promo code MOMANDDAD40. Learn more at littlepassports.com/momanddad.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, October 22nd, the live from basically the White House edition. Yes, we are live in Washington, D.C. Dan's wife is here. Woo! My parents are here, so don't embarrass me. And the Secret Service is here. I'm Allison Benedict, an editor at Slate, and the mom of Harry, who is finally 7.
One Happy
of my
birthday,
children
Harry.
Finally had a birthday, yes. Sam, who is 4, and Wally, who's 2.
I'm Dan Coyce. I'm also an editor at Slate. I'm the dad of Lyra, who is 10, and Harper, who is 8. Hello, Allison.
Hello. On today's show, we'll talk to Stephen Thompson, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, about the joys and pitfalls of passing along your pop culture taste to your children. Then White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett will be here to talk about her personal work-life balance, the future of family leave, and the Iran deal. And if that weren't enough, John Dickerson, excellent father, Slate columnist, Slate podcaster, host of Face the Nation, will join us to dish on presidential parenting and talk about his own process of abandoning his children for the campaign trail every 4 years. Plus a very special triumphs and fails, and we'll take parenting questions from the audience. Dan, do we have announcements?
We do. First of all of you who are listening to this, and I guess everyone in the room, please like our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. I am there every single day telling people that they owe me 47 cents for playing Ace of Hates. We are coming to you tonight live from the stage of Woolly Mammoth Theater in D.C., and listeners in the D.C. area should definitely check out Woolly's next show, which is called Winners and Losers. It opens on October 27th. This two-man show starts as a seemingly harmless drinking game separating the champs from the chumps, but it gets complicated fast. It got great reviews in New York. I can't wait to see it. I've already got my tickets. You can get tickets today at woollymammoth.net and use the code SLATE for a discount in the second week of shows. And finally, listeners in New York, the Slate Superfest is coming to Broadway. Join us at Town Hall on November 16th is the Political Gab Fest featuring John Dickerson, the Culture Gab Fest, and Hang Up and Listen featuring Josh Levine.
Who's in the audience.
Who's somewhere. In the audience. There he is. as they battle it out to see who rules the Great White Way. I will be emceeing in what would be my Broadway debut if it wasn't for all those shows playing Tom Collins in my dreams. Go to slate.com/superfestnyc for tickets on to Triumphs and Fails. Allison.
Okay, you guys know the drill. Every episode, we either admit to a fail or a triumph. but this week, we're going to shake it up a little bit. A couple of weeks ago, I told listeners about my issue with asking Harry about his day. Normally, I just say, hey, Harry, how was your day? Or how was school today? And he rolls his eyes and groans and falls on the ground as if just the sound of my voice has killed him. So listeners wrote in with really good suggestions. The best one, the one that we loved the most, was called Two Truths and a Lie, which was making it a game. Everyone in the family goes around and says two true things that happened that day and one made-up thing that happened that day, and then everyone else has to guess what the lie was, and it's really fun, and yet you learn a couple things about your kid's day. So we are going to do Parenting Triumphs and Fails, Two Truths and a Lie edition. It's a very high concept, so stick with us here.
It couldn't possibly go wrong.
So I'm going to say either three fails or three triumphs. Two of them are true. One is a lie. At the end, with your applause, you will guess which one is the lie. Ready.
I actually don't know which one is a lie, so I'm also going to vote.
You can vote too, yes. Okay, so I'm doing fails because I like to play to type. Here are my three fails. Number one, I let Harry listen to music on iTunes Shuffle with headphones without checking what music was on Shuffle first. And he came running into the kitchen screaming, guess what song just came on? Fuck school! Which is a great replacement song.
That sounds real.
Number two, Sam has been begging me to send Lunchables to school. And he goes to a Jewish preschool, and the only Lunchables I could find were the ones with ham in them, which they would not allow. And I told him this, and he didn't care. It wasn't fair. And so instead of saying, like, life's not fair, them's the breaks, I said, all right, I'll just pack them. The school will have to deal with it, and the school will be the bad guys. When the school called me to gently say, please don't pack a ham in your lunch, I did not anticipate that Sam may have told them that this happened, so I sold my husband out and said, like, oh, I didn't. I told my husband, but he didn't. And they were like, no, Sam told us that you packed them. So, okay, first, fuck school. Second, Hamgate. Third, last week was respect week at Harry's school. They learned a lot about bullying and how to deal when a kid is bullying you. And so Harry came home and told me that a girl in his class had been bullying him, and he wanted me to talk to her parents. He said she was the top number one girl bully in the school, and I didn't. I didn't talk to her parents because I wasn't really sure what was going on, and because I'm friends with her parents, and I couldn't really figure out how to have that conversation. He's asked me repeatedly to have this conversation with them, and clearly he is doing what he was told to do, like find an adult that you trust and tell them. And I just, you know, I betrayed that trust, and I just keep blowing him off. So, three good fails. Which is the lie?
This all sounds so plausible.
Fuck school.
All right, by audience vote. Yeah. Fuck school. Hamgate. Bullies. So the audience seems to be voting for Hamgate.
The audience is correct.
Wow, nice job.
Because what I actually did was open up the Lunchables, take this ham out, and put turkey in, and then I sent it. Okay, Dan.
Whew. Okay, here are my two truths and a lie. Fail number one, I knocked over a toddler and made her cry while dancing with Lyra at a bar mitzvah, and she was completely horrified, and I said, that toddler shouldn't have been on the dance floor. Fail number two, Harper wanted to give me a full makeover, And I gave her a very careful answer about how it had nothing to do with gender. Mommies and daddies can both wear makeup, but right now I just don't want to. And she said, no, I know daddies. Daddies don't care what they look like. Fail number three. I made my kids cry by yelling at them during a viewing of Back to the Future 2 because they wouldn't stop asking, why does Marty's mom look like that? And why is Biff rich? So those are my three. So it's Bar Mitzvah Toddler, Full Makeover, and Back to the Future 2. So let's vote. Bar Mitzvah Toddler. That does sound like something I would do. Full Makeover. Back to the Future 2.
Back to the Future 1.
Okay, you're mostly wrong. I did, in fact, make my kids cry during Back to the Future 2 because they can't wait for the movie to just answer their fucking question. You learn why Biff is rich. It's like the whole point of the movie.
Can I interrupt just to say that Back to the Future was torture to me as a child. Did anyone else have this experience? Like, I couldn't understand the concept. How could you go back to the future? And I would cry about it to my parents and ask a million questions, so I sympathize with your children.
Yes, you're also the worst. And I did knock over that toddler at the bar mitzvah, and I did say that to my kid. But the lie was about my makeover. Last night, in fact, Harper came into the kitchen, and she said, Daddy, can I practice makeup on your face and be your triumph? Mommy told me to say that. All right, let's bring out our first guest. My issue with Back to the Future 2 made me really want to talk to an expert about how we, in fact, experience pop culture with our kids. And then the Star Wars trailer came out last night, making me want to talk about it even more. And there's no better person to talk about pop culture and kids with than pop culture expert and grown-up kid, Stephen Thompson. Stephen was the founding editor of the AV Club and is now an editor at NPR Music. He's the co-creator of NPR's great podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour, and appears every week on that show. Most importantly, he is a proud Wisconsin man. Please welcome Stephen Thompson. All right, so the big pop culture news this week, Stephen, is the Force Awakens, the Star Wars trailer that came out last night. There were like five teasers, pre-trailer teasers to the trailer that came out in the days before. Tell me, how aware are your kids of this sort of onrushing pop culture juggernaut that will one day be the defining event of their childhoods?
I mean... Well, see, we say that. You and I are both schlubs in our 40s, and I'm sorry... I am a schlub.
Yes. We're all schlubs in our 40s up here.
Okay. No,
did you hear something?
and so there's this certain assumption. I think you actually get at an interesting point, which is we assume that this is going to be a massive moment in their childhoods. I think the only way that The Force Awakens is going to be a formative experience for certainly my kids, but I think kids in general, is that it's going to teach an entire wave of young people about crushing disappointment. As episode one did for the previous generation.
But it didn't. The previous generation of kids thought episode one was great. It only crushingly disappointed people our age who are already prone to crushing disappointment.
That's true. Our generation is definitely, we are the disappointment generation. I think you make a certain point. Actually, my kids and I are not big Star Wars people. And I think in general, one of the big differences between when you and I were kids, Star Wars, I'm 43, Star Wars came out when I was 5, and Star Wars was one of the, if not the only game in town, it was one of the very few games in town. And so if you wanted to see Star Wars, you went in the theater, maybe you went during like a revival screening, there were ways to see it, midnight screenings and stuff, but you didn't have it, you didn't have everything that ever was available to you all the time. And so nowadays, I think a lot of kids are going to go to see The Force Awakens and just be like, huh, and then just, you know, maybe obsess over the next thing.
It's just the movie I saw.
So how hard do you work to pass on to your kids? Like, do you want your kids to understand what's so important about Star Wars? Or do you want them to, like, find their own?
I mean, I try as much as possible to let my kids, and they're just going to be off on the side, like, shaking their heads and going, no. But I try as much as possible to sort of put pop culture in front of them for them to accept or reject, and to try to take their response at face value. Like, nothing in the world made me happier than the fact that my daughter's favorite movie is Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And nothing in the world will make me sadder than when she reflexively rejects it because I just said that it made me so happy.
Sorry, I stepped on your joke.
So she loves Pee-wee's Big Adventure. She loves Beetlejuice. We've watched hundreds of hours of The Simpsons and Futurama together and bonded over that. And that's been wonderful, but I try to always gird myself for the possibility that the kids are going to be bored and they're going to want to do something that is not of interest to me. And it's one of the most important things that we can do as parents is not view sharing pop culture with our kids as like a parenting perk or birthright. It's a privilege when it happens. It's exciting when it happens. But we're just as likely to have our hopes dashed. And I've been very lucky, not only because my kids are, don't tell them I said this, but my kids are actually great.
Dad.
So we've gotten to have a lot of those bonding experiences of sharing that stuff together. But there's a lot of stuff where the kids reflectively run to the opposite side of the house when football is on because they do not want to watch football with shouty dad. And I have to work extra hard to understand things that they're working on, like Pokemon and math.
Do you guys, though, do you feel some sense of pride when your kid likes something that you think is cool?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a reflection on the
of
thing.
How awesome I am.
No, I'm going for false humility
here,
so sit tight. I mean, yeah, there's a sense of, like, clearly I have done something right if my children appreciate Pee-wee's Big Adventure on the level that I do. But at the same time, like, you really are trying to raise individuals with their own sets of interests. My parents were/are two of the world's foremost experts on comic books. Like, when Pop Culture Happy Hour did a panel at Comic-Con in 2014, we went as guests of my mother.
Your mom is a legend.
My mom and dad edited a magazine called Comics Buyer's Guide, and my mom is still, like, you know, all about comics. And I reflexively rebelled against that a little bit. Not rebelled, like, tell with you, mom and dad, I'm not going to read Richie Rich or whatever. But, like, I found my own pocket of obsession that was different from that. Even though that same incredibly fortunate ability to make a living on enthusiasm, I managed to inherit from them. I make a living enthusing about music, and now on the podcast on Pop Culture Happy Hour about music and or about movies and television and stuff like that. And that I ultimately got from my parents, even though the specific things they were most excited about sharing with me. You talk about pop culture fails. My parents sat me down and had me watch Midnight Cowboy with them.
At age
about 13. Because it's such a good movie. And it's really important for my education that I sit down and watch it with them.
All right, so in my family, we've had a lot more luck passing along music than movies. Movies, recently, actually, are two experiences. We tried Bad News Bears, mm-hmm. which, like, has anyone watched Bad News Bears lately?
Oh,
it
yeah.
would not be made today, that is for sure.
I have
There's
had
a lot of slurs in that movie.
I've had several experiences of sitting down with my kids and forgetting about all the rampant homophobia.
Yeah. So. And then E.T., which they just, like, didn't get. Like, in yeah. the moment at the end of the movie when, like, Drew Barrymore is crying and everyone's crying and they're saying goodbye to E.T., Harry said, did they shut off the camera and cut onions and then turn the camera back on? I was like, which was devastating. He wanted to know how much all the actors made. Like, he was not buying it at all.
Was John like, well, hold on, let me check.
Yeah. Right. So that was not successful. But music, it's been much more successful in our family, like getting, I don't even know if we, yes, I guess we have worked at it because we haven't played kids' music.
Mm-hmm.
And because music is, I feel like music is different than movies or TV because it's something that by necessity, and if you are sort of being together in a way that I like to be together with my family, it's something that everyone can share on a day-to-day, like everyday right. basis. Like if we have family movie night, you know, every couple of weeks and I yell at my kids and then it's done. And it was great. But with music, that can be a part of our like everyday lives.
In the car.
And, yeah. And yeah. so, yeah, we have also, like that has felt more dire to me, this need to like make sure that my kids have like some connection to the music that I enjoy listening to, even as I often am learning about music from them.
Right. And I think that's one of the important things, is that you take the time to learn music as much from your kids as they're taking from you, to not have every music discussion be the Sermon on the Mount, because that is the thing that will fail. But, you know, one of the nice things about music, and obviously I work at NPR Music and I'm marinating in music all the time and sharing it with my kids all the time, but one of the great things about it is that, unlike family movie night, listening to music together can be very passive. So it can be on, but there's nothing homework about it. You're in the car, you know, you're on a road trip, we drive back to Wisconsin, we listen to a ton of music, and maybe the kids latch on to something and maybe they don't. You know, so as much as possible, I try to just steer them in the direction of the things that they take an interest in. I'm waiting for to grab onto a little line and then like bury them in music based on their stated preference. So, for example, my daughter got into Guitar Hero on the Nintendo Wii, and suddenly that opened up a whole new world of loving Ozzy Osbourne. And so, like, her favorite song of all time is Crazy Train, and she dressed as Ozzy for Halloween last year. And, like, ultimately, that, I'm not going to lie, that made me feel like kind of the coolest dad ever.
Can we hear a little bit of Crazy Train, please, from the booth?
This is the happiest she's been during this entire taping.
I definitely have experiences like that too. For me, like my ultimate cool dad trademark sign moment was when I convinced my kids to go to a Slater Kinney show with me at the 9:30 Club, because I like seeing those women up on stage being amazing made me feel like, oh, I want my kids to see this. And so like I bought them earplugs and we went to the show and we watched it and they really, really liked it. And I felt like the greatest dad ever. Oh, yeah. And then as we were on our way out, we left about two-thirds of the way through the show because it was really late. And Lyra took the earplugs out as we were on our way out. And then she was just walking like this. Oh. And the looks that people gave me, I felt the worst. And I kept yelling at people as loud as I could. She had earplugs. She just took them out while we're leaving. Some guy took his earplugs out and tried to give them to her.
Oh.
I said, don't take those.
And what you were totally hoping for was like the walk back to the car to be like, Dad, tell us about feminism.
It was my ears are really ringing, Dad.
Okay, well, in my house, I'd say my husband is a music tyrant. So I grew up loving Billy Joel with my parents. That was like the shared, but we don't have a lot of Billy Joel in Maplewood, New Jersey.
Everyone else in Maplewood, New Jersey has a lot of Billy
right.
Joel.
Yeah. So yeah, since early days, I would say my kids have gravitated toward the music that my husband grew up listening to. So right now they're really into the Replacements, as I said, with Fuck School. And the most popular song when we get into the car now, the two-year-old Wally asks for Kids Don't Follow, which I don't know if you're familiar with this song, but it opens with the police trying to break up a teen party because there's a lot of drinking and drugs happening at the party. And then it launches into like some really fast punk, and it's all about kids not listening to their parents.
The party is over with. Grab your stuff and go. And then nobody goes to jail.
What don't you do?
It's a great song, though.
It's a great song.
And then we had to talk about the overdoses and
sure, yeah. I mean, well, so one thing I was really happy to figure out when we were researching this topic, when we were prepping for this, was that has in fact been a really interesting Cornell study that suggests that young adults, rather than like reflexively rejecting the music that their parents love, they often feel a very real affection towards specifically the music that their parents listen to at their own age.
Yeah.
So like the study showed that young adults find, basically they find us adorable
We're like pets.
We're like pets, yeah. Remember, what, they can't believe once we were young.
Right.
But we guess that Prince song is pretty good. all right, well, thank you, Stephen Thompson, so much for joining us. Pop Culture Happy Hour, it's a fantastic show. Everyone should listen to it. Everyone, give it up for Stephen Thompson.
Okay, we're going to do our first ad. This week's first sponsor is Book 3 in the very funny science-themed children's book series from Amulet Books, Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo. The New York Times best-selling team of John Sheska and Brian Biggs have created a unique world of fun, integrating real science facts into a book full of adventure, humor, and robots. The six-book series follows the adventures of kid inventor and scientist Frank Einstein, his best friend Watson, and his two robots Clink and Clank. The books encourage middle grade readers to question the way things work and how they, too, can experiment with science. Frank Einstein's quest in Book 3 is to unlock the power behind the science of the human body to help his friend Jane Goodall be a better baseball pitcher. The book has tons of cool human body facts, is perfect for fans of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, and is great for new chapter book readers who are looking for something funny and smart to read. That's Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo. Check it out.
All right. So typically this is the part of the show where we answer a listener question, and we still want you listeners to call us with those questions so we can answer them in future episodes. If you have a question you want us to answer about parenting, give us a call at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE. And leave us a message on our voicemail. But tonight, in honor of our amazing live audience here in Washington, D.C., we are going to answer your parenting questions. Before we start answering these questions, we want to bring up a special guest. Longtime listeners have heard a lot about a certain person in my life without ever getting to meet her. But we thought it was time to let her have a turn on the mic to tell her side of the story. And rebut all the bullshit that I've been saying for years. So welcome, as our third question answerer tonight, my attractive lawyer wife, Alia Smith.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm the mother of Pip, who's two. And my question is about gift giving. And I'm interested to know how in your household you divide up the task of selecting gifts for your own kids and selecting gifts for other kids.
What a great question to ask while my wife is up here on stage. Well, obviously I'm so involved in that process. Alia, you can take this one.
Yeah, I feel like actually we divide this up sort of along our lines of interest. When it's somebody who's going to like comics or books of some kind, I normally delegate that to Dan. But my only real gift advice is don't do craft activity sets. It's a little young for, you know, two-year-olds are not going to get those, but every birthday we get like a million bracelet-making things and other types of...
Spirographs.
Yeah, and I just give them away to other people.
Yeah.
So so that's my advice. But for two-year-olds, I would say, in general, our go-to gift is books. And happily for me, I have a book expert in the family, so that helps.
But yeah, that's a good point, that those craft kits that you'll start getting at like maybe age four, those are like the fruitcakes of child gifts. thank you. Thank you for that question. Next, my coworker.
Hi, I'm Hannah. Hannah. Disagree with what you just said about the craft kits.
Maybe you're more crafty than I am.
No, it's just like they just like sit with them. They can't understand them, but it takes them a lot of time to like work their way. So it's like
Hannah,
television, but not.
Save the advice.
Okay, sorry. So I'm Hannah, and I have three children, and I have a teenage daughter, Noah, and a son who's 12, Jacob, and a little kid, Gideon, who's 7. And my question is about roller coasters. I took Gideon to Harry Potter World in Orlando recently, which is a pretty extravagant present. Like, we rented a hotel, and we went there with a friend, and it was like this big, big, huge deal because he just finished the Harry Potter series. And then he really did not want to go on those awesome roller coasters, and I did. So do you force your child to go on a roller coaster when he really wants to not go on the roller coaster?
Please stay at the mic so we can find out how this ends.
No.
Yeah, no.
I was always the kid who was scared of the roller coaster. I would like get to the front of the line and be like, I have to go to the bathroom. Or I don't think you force him, but can't you go without him? Can't he wait for you?
I totally forced him to go on the roller coaster.
Hannah!
On, like, all the roller coasters.
Wait, it's like... Wait,
even
but
the dueling dragons?
How do you hide?
Like, even if he wasn't high enough, I would, like, lift him up so...
And was he like, no, Mom, no, I'm scared, don't make
no,
me do this?
No, he developed a coping mechanism. Oh, my God, this is terrible. I didn't even know this was terrible. That's what's really terrible. he would tell me... Okay, for that one, I closed my eyes 73% of the time. And for this one, I closed my eyes 84% of the time. So that was interesting to him to know, like, to tell me how much he closed his eyes.
I don't think you can scare the shit out of your kid into liking roller coasters.
Okay, so that was a fail.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Hannah.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Jess. We have Moxie, who's 3, and Keen, who's 9 months. And... no matter what, my husband is taking Moxie, who's 3, to the Star Wars movie. So we heard, and I appreciate, about how to manage my husband's expectations. How do we get Moxie through the movie?
I will say that although I think it's questionable, I guess, to take a 3-year-old to Star Wars, I think it's good to do it early because we wanted to introduce our girls to Star Wars when they were in early elementary school, and they were like, no, Star Wars is for boys. We're not interested in that. And so I think if you can take her before she starts to get that attitude and she develops an appreciation, that would be a good thing.
Could you, like, hire a teen to just go with your husband so he has someone to see Star Wars with?
That's a possibility.
Yeah, my advice was going to be bring an iPad with Thomas on it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And just, like, sit in the back row, yeah. All the way in the back row. Also, don't do 3D, for God's sake. Hello, welcome.
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm a fellow North Arlington resident, and I have no children. I am not pregnant.
Welcome.
And the question I'm asking is actually because I haven't found, not great advice, on when you are pregnant and you want to be a responsible, loyal employee, like we just heard, how do you tell your employer? It doesn't seem like there's a lot of great information about the best way to approach that.
I also want to know when, like at what point do you tell your boss?
Well, we work in very different environments, right? So we might have different answers to this. At Slate, it's quite a supportive and family friendly place. So I told my boss when I was, I think probably before I was 3 months pregnant. I think once I started telling other people, I told my boss, but I wasn't nervous about it. I mean, I think I said it in a very, like, matter-of-fact way. It's allowed. You're allowed to be pregnant. And you're going to get, you know, you should expect your leave, and you should get your leave, and you should not say it in an apologetic way.
Right. And they hired me when I was 22 and a single female. Like, it's one of those things where I think all of the demographic things showed up of, well, we've gotten 5 years out of her. Like,
yeah, you've been a ticking time bomb.
I know. Well, that's honestly how it felt when I got married, because at my bridal shower, I work with doctors, and they were like, you know, you're getting married 40 weeks before Christmas. You don't want a surprise. Man.
I don't think they're surprised when a 30-something woman comes in and says they're pregnant. But, Alia, did you have a different experience?
No, I mean, I work at a very supportive law firm, and I think I waited 3 months, but mostly just because that's typical for when you tell people outside of your immediate family anyway, and they were very supportive. I mean, it was a little bit odd for me. I was the first person in our office in New York ever to take maternity leave or to go out on leave, and I work for a boss at the time who doesn't have any children. So it was, you know, I have a colleague who tells a story about having to go in and tell her boss that she was taking maternity leave, and all she could think to herself was, oh my God, he's going to know I had sex. And so, like, there's, like, a little bit of that because you don't necessarily want your boss to, like, think about that. But in general, it was fine. And I do think that people, unless you work for a really horrible company, are going to be happy for you.
I do think that one piece of advice I would give is to do your best to learn what the policy is before you go into that conversation so you can make sure that you are advocating for the policy that you get. And if there are things that you're not getting that you think you ought to be getting, that you can make that case.
But it doesn't have to be the same conversation. No, I mean, you can tell your boss you're pregnant and you still have 6 months before you're going to go out on leave, so you don't necessarily have to make all those decisions right away.
Wow.
Good, thank you.
Good one. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Mara, and I'm expecting my first, and I'm interested in everyone's thoughts about how much to push back against parents and other relatives versus chilling out about things like sugar and giving kids sugar and really gendered toys and the like. My mother, for example, is insistent that kids must have juice because otherwise they won't get fiber and won't be able to poop. And
that's such a specific belief.
And gives cookies before dinner and all these sorts of things. And so I'm just curious what's your approach to letting grandparents kind of do what they're going to do versus pushing back?
May I speak to this since my mother-in-law is in the audience? The pusher, the sugar pusher. I get annoyed and say no all the time. Right, Sandy? Where are you, Sandy? Mm-hmm. Where are you? Yeah, she doesn't care. She just keeps on bringing it. But I think it's okay to be like, it's enough. Like, I think it's okay to let, you know, you want the grandparents to have their pleasures, but like, if you don't think if your kid is pooping okay and doesn't need the fiber from juice every day, I think it's fine to say, like, actually, Mom, he's drinking milk.
I don't know. I think I disagree.
Well, I think it's different if they're trying to impose a whole philosophy on you is one thing, and you can reject that. But we have a philosophy that if our parents are taking care of our children for us, they can do whatever.
Carte blanche. In summary, Momfno, we're on your side. All right, thank you. Thank you, all of you, for your questions.
Bye,
thank you, Alia Smith.
Okay, let's hear from our second sponsor, Prudential. Today's 40-somethings are charting their own courses, sometimes by choice, but many times out of necessity. Caring for aging parents, starting new careers midlife, juggling today's financial realities with planning for retirement, and much more. Prudential's 40-40 vision brings these challenges and others into sharper focus through real-life interviews and commentary from 40-somethings. You can check those out, plus a 4-part podcast on first-time parenthood in your 40s with radio and television personality Faith Saley at slate.com/4040vision/family.
All right, let's move on.
In addition to secretly running the government and making Sean Hannity's head explode, White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett is a working single mother. Last year, she headed the White House Summit on Working Families, which was focused on raising the minimum wage and advocating for paid parental leave. She's here today to talk to us. She's here today to talk to us about what makes a family-friendly workplace, what working parents need from the private sector and the government, and to announce Joe Biden's candidacy for President of the United States. Please welcome Valerie Jarrett.
Thank you, Allison. How did you know the vice president asked me to make that announcement on his behalf? He thought this would be the perfect venue.
The Woolly
and he would
theater.
Let me
People
do
were
it, because why would he want to do it? I could just do it, right?
We're a major market.
Okay, so if you really secretly ran the government, what 3 policies would you immediately implement to help working families?
Well, you mentioned a couple of them, and we had this White House summit last year, and it isn't going to be a surprise to any of you the kinds of issues that were important. Workplace flexibility is very important. I can give you a story about that. Equal pay for equal work, that's pretty important for both the men and for the women. Now that women are half the workforce, you want to make sure that their contribution to the family income is commensurate with the men. Child care, affordable child care. In over half of our country, child care costs more than public school college. That's a lot of money. And so particularly for young families who are struggling, that's very important. And then paid leave. You're not going to believe this. Well, maybe you will. I don't think you're going to believe this. We are the only developed country in the world that doesn't have a paid leave policy. The only one. How could that be? The United States is supposed to be the innovators and the creators of all of the top-notch jobs in the world. How in the world are we going to compete if we don't have paid leave? And so one of our policy initiatives is to try to get Congress to pass paid leave. But in the meantime, in case you haven't noticed, Congress doesn't pass very much at all. And so we're going around the country, and the Secretary of Labor and I have gone state by state, city by city, and encouraged local municipalities and states to pass paid leave policies, and several have. And then there are lots of employers who are not only passing the policies, but also requiring their suppliers and their vendors to do the same.
So what do you think, Netflix recently, and I think other companies have followed suit, recently announced an unlimited leave policy. So
it's unlimited up to the first year. So you can take as much as you want. Facebook also is requiring it, not providing it not just for their employees, but for their vendors. Microsoft also requiring more of their vendors. So I think those are very important policies in allowing not just men, but women too, men and women, to be able to spend time with their family and come back to work. In fact, we just had three senior women at the White House return from their 3 months of paid maternity leave. And while they were gone, there were three women who were acting in their place. And I think it's terrific. And we welcome them back, and they haven't missed a beat. And I think as a result of our attitude in the White House, and it starts with the top, the president and first lady really wanted to create an environment where you can work really, really hard, but also raise your children, I think they're very, very loyal in return. So very important policies. And if you can do it in the White House, you can do it anywhere.
So you, many, many years ago, you decided to leave your job at a big law firm so that you could spend more time with your daughter, Laura, when she was young. And now, these days, Laura, if I'm correct, is a lawyer, right?
Yes, in a big law firm. I don't know what happened.
So I guess one question
really,
I have...
she was not listening to me.
Based on what you see from her experience and what you see in dealing with companies, do you think that law firms or the legal profession in particular, do you think things are better there? Or is this a problem that she is eventually going to face if she ends up having kids?
I think it's going to be a problem she's going to face. I think the service industry, as a general rule, particularly now with technology allowing them to work 24 hours a day from wherever they are, it's really challenging. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what firms around the country are willing to do to keep talent. And she's a better lawyer than I was, and she enjoys it more than I did. So that's great. I didn't just leave because I wanted to spend time with her. I also left because I was just miserable doing what I was doing. But I think it's very hard. There are companies that have figured it out and have given their employees the kind of flexibility they need to both meet the needs outside of their office and the needs at home, but we still have a long way to go before it is ubiquitous. And I think they're going to lose a lot of talent as a result of that. For example, computer science. Women stay on average 3 years in the field of computer science after they've gone through all that trouble of taking those wretched classes that you have to take to be a computer scientist. And then because of the culture is the number one reason why they'll tell you they leave. And so we have to change that. We really do.
So switching gears a little bit, your mother has spent her entire career focused on early childhood education. I don't want you to have to speak for her, but what would she say? How would she say we're doing right now as a country?
We are doing better. And this is something else the president has called on Congress to do, which they have not done, which is to fully fund quality, affordable early childhood education. The studies have shown every dollar that you invest in affordable, quality early childhood education saves you $7 down the line. It's one of the very important metrics for success. And you can't stop with good early childhood education, but you certainly put your children on a better trajectory if they have it. So again, cities and states around the country are investing in early childhood education. I think it is when my mom started Erickson Institute, which is a graduate school in early childhood education, many, many years ago, 45 years ago, I think it was, nobody even thought about it as a profession. We weren't teaching teachers how to teach preschool age children. And now it has evolved, and you hear not only President Obama, but candidates on the campaign trail talking about the importance of early childhood education. So we've come a long way, but it's still not fully funded. And as a result, you see disparities, and usually it's the low-income kids that suffer.
A recent This American Life episode that Allison has recommended on the show was a fascinating study into school integration, using a school in Missouri as its example. Does the administration have plans to push in any way this notion that one of the greatest ways to improve a school is to and to improve the school experience for minority students is to find ways to integrate those schools that are currently not doing that?
Well, we believe that diversity is a strength. It's not just good for the low-income kids, it's good for the other kids as well. Mm-hmm. And so our view is that to the degree you can give your children an enriched experience and expose them to ideas, it's one of my, just to go on a tangent for a second, one of my real concerns about this on-demand society that we're in, where you can receive information from wherever you want it, and what is tending to happen is that people gravitate towards venues of information that agree with them. So, for example, people who watch Fox tend not to watch MSNBC. And people who watch MSNBC tend to not watch Fox. And I think that that's a problem. And so I think, as a general rule, anytime you can create an enriched environment where there is diversity and your children are exposed to people who don't necessarily have the same life experiences as they do, it adds to the experience for everybody.
Do you think there's any way that Americans can be convinced at this point that that's true, that Americans at large can be convinced that it's worth it to move people around and make schools as diverse as they can possibly be?
I think it's really challenging. And as we have seen over the last 50 years, the pendulum has swung back in a lot of the schools because of geography and because for so long, people who could move out of the cities did. But now I think cities are vibrant. And I know I'm from Chicago. Many of the people who maybe 10 or 15 years ago would have left the city are now staying in the city. They're putting more pressure on the school system to improve. And I think that that's healthy for all of the kids.
Right. It's not just a question of integrating the schools. It's integrating neighborhoods.
Right.
And improving the overall quality. And we need to support our teachers. Teachers need to be making a lot more money than they're making now. I can't imagine why you'd put your most precious thing in the hands of somebody who isn't being paid adequately for the job that they're doing.
What is it like being a working parent in the White House?
Well, for me, it's easy because my daughter's going to be 30 next week. So believe me, but one of my mottos is, you know, you can have it all, but you can't necessarily have it all at the same time. And believe me, 25 years ago, I was holding on by my fingertips. Even when I left the law firm, I went to work for the city. I actually think I worked harder working for city government than I did working for the law firm, but I had flexible hours. So in a sense, my work product is finished. She's pretty much baked by right now. But I will tell you, and I always have to tell this story because it's a good example of what I was talking about earlier in terms of loyalty. I went to work for the city, and I worked for Mayor Daley. And anyone who's from Chicago or knew Mayor Daley, he's kind of a tough boss, and he scared me a lot, particularly in the beginning. And I can remember being in his office early on. I was Commissioner of Planning and Development, and I was sitting there, and the Corporation Counsel was one of my best friends, and she was sitting opposite me. And he's talking, and we're kind of not really, again, not paying attention. It's a bad habit I have. And we're looking at each other, making eye contact, and he finally realizes that we're not paying any attention to him at all. And he goes, "What is more important than what's going on here?" And in this moment of truth, I said to him, "The Halloween parade starts in 25 minutes, or 20 minutes, and it's 25 minutes away." And, you know, I kind of held my breath to see what he would do. And he said, "Then what are you doing here?" And I am telling you, the relief that I felt as Susan and I are like flying down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, and we pull up in front of the school just as the doors open, and these little darlings come out in second grade, and they're in their costumes, and of course they're looking through the audience for us, and well, what if we hadn't been there? And so one of my advice to young parents is that to the degree that you find an employer where you can be honest, and you don't feel like you have to sneak to go to the Halloween parade or soccer or take them to a doctor's appointment or something like that, then you know that you're in the right place. And for the employers, the loyalty I feel to Mayor Daley to this day, if he calls me and he asks me for anything at all, I still remember that Halloween parade. And so my daughter's now grown, and so I don't have the challenges of a young child and trying to meet the demands of a very demanding job, so I can work 20 hours a day. And after work, I can come here and be with you, and then I can go back to work because there's no little kid waiting for me. And I don't get out much, so this is fun for me. But it's hard. It's very hard. And no matter where you are, when you're parenting young children, it is just exhausting. And I think you just have to get used to that fact. And all I can assure you is that they do, in fact, eventually grow up.
Well, thank you so much, Valerie. We're so
glad
you
came to
join. No, you stay. Hang out.
You're keeping me from having to go back to work.
Thanks so much, Valerie.
Nice to meet you.
Keep your kids busy after school with Little Passports, the award-winning subscription for kids. Pen pals Sam and Sophia will send your child a monthly package in the mail, each highlighting a new global destination like Kenya or Spain. Follow the journey on the wall-sized world map and enjoy learning through letters, souvenirs, stickers, fun little activities, and more. Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners can save 40% on their first month today with promo code MOMANDDAD40. That's MOMANDDAD40. Learn more at littlepassports.com/momanddad. All right, let's move on to our third and final segment today when our third and amazing guest, ever since President George Washington brought his daughter Nellie Custis, well, she was actually his unofficially adopted step-granddaughter. Things were really complicated back then. Ever since he brought her along to social occasions in New York, presidents have had responsibilities not only to their countries, but to their kids. Here in the nation's capital, where the president's oldest daughter is thinking about her college decision right now, let's have a conversation about presidential parenting. So please welcome the host of Face the Nation, a co-host of the Political Gabfest, and actual cool dad, John Dickerson. You brought your research materials up. I love it.
Well, because you've already said more about presidential parenting than I know. So I have to bring
material.
I found
that by Googling presidential parenting.
It is curious that it was, yes, George Washington. Nuts. I knew you didn't know that earlier.
Of course I didn't know that. John, welcome. So we thought it would be fun to talk with you through a few presidential parenting triumphs and fails. So let's start by asking, who was a president who you think really nailed being a dad or a mom, if there have ever been any lady presidents?
I don't think there have been. I don't know what Google says about that.
I forgot to look that up.
Well, it depends what you mean by good or bad. So on the let them do whatever the hell they want front, that's my favorite, which is Teddy Roosevelt with Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who has to be the best first child. I mean, the best child of a president. She, remember when some staffer got in trouble for writing about how the Obama girls, when they rolled their eyes at that stupid turkey pardoning moment, and the staffer said, oh, they should sort of pick it up when they're in public. They should know they're... So that staffer was then fired for that. So the Obama girls were rolling their eyes. Alice Roosevelt Longworth was rolling cigarettes in, like, the early 20th century. She kept a snake in her purse. She had a flask of booze that could fit in her gloves. She was smoking, rode streetcars, went to boxing matches, hung out with men, and played poker. She was great. And so they went to Teddy Roosevelt and said, hey, you know, and oh, by the way, the cone of silence around presidential kids, which sort of started with Amy Carter, was completely reversed. So Alice Roosevelt Longworth would often be on the front page, and whatever her father was doing, whatever war he had launched that day, was not covered, you know, but on like A12. But when Alice was out with the boys, it was the, and they, she had packs of reporters following her, and then later she lived to be, I think, 96. And she was still in Washington, still doing these kinds of things. She used to go to the boxing matches. And the family tradition was you'd hold up a white handkerchief so that when the cameras showed the boxing match, they could see the Roosevelt family or her and her party there with the handkerchiefs. And she had all those great things. She had that needlepoint pillow that said, if you can't say something nice about someone else, come sit next to me. she once described someone as being weaned. They looked like they had been weaned on a pickle. Which is a great line. She had another one that said that my motto in life is fill what is empty, empty what is full, and scratch where it itches. So she had practical advice as well. So anyway, so her father, who the most famous quote, though, is when he was asked about her, he said, look, I can either run the country or deal with Alice, but I cannot do both. So he just let her ride. And so that was probably the best presidential planning. Although, I mean, President Obama so far, you know, there has not been a single public incident with his kids. They've seemed to be, you know, able to balance all of that.
Is that the measure?
What, man? Well, think about what that life is like. I mean, so if kids at that age don't want to be defined by their parents and don't want to be locked in either physically or emotionally, you couldn't design a life that is more confining than a presidential life. You have the Secret Service tromping around everywhere you go at school. Your parents are, you are constantly being defined as an adjunct to your parents. even if you aren't actually, you assume everybody who's whispering and saying, oh, that's, you know, the president's daughter. And you live in this crazy, as President Clinton called it, the finest piece of real estate in the federal penal system. I mean, it's you live in a gilded prison. So I don't think that's what you want when you're that age. Now, I'm sure there are all these wonderful, great perks, but psychologically, you got to
work all
that out.
No, I just meant, is that the measure of a good president as parent, the kids who don't...
Oh, yeah, that was where that sentence was going. Sorry, I took a, I took a left at Albuquerque. What I was trying to say is that given all of that pressure on a kid, you could imagine them doing what kids apparently do, which is acting out when they are confronted by pressures not of their own making.
Is there a president in our long and proud history who just blew it, who just had a tremendous presidential parenting fail?
Well, let me think. Well, depends what you think of Grover Cleveland.
Hate that guy.
So in 1884, in the election of 1884, which everyone here remembers... So anyway, in 1884, Grover Cleveland is losing or about to lose to James G. Blaine in maybe in part, but anyway, the big story in the election, of course, was this illegitimate child and born from an affair he had with Maria Halpin. Anyway, so he, depending on whose story you believe, he got Maria committed to an insane asylum and then had the kid spirited away and basically put with a foster family. So that's not the way you're supposed to behave. The way Maria describes it, he basically raped her. And this was adjudicated in the campaign and would have been a problem except for James G. Blaine had his own issues, including like mountains of scandals and things. So the measure was basically whether you misbehaved in your private life or misbehaved in your public life. And Cleveland won on that one. But I think as a parent, he was, you know, not so awesome.
Is there any way you can be president and be a parent in the way that we think of being a parent? Like, is it possible?
Unless in the way I think of being a parent is away from home all the time. So you can be very successful at that. One upside is, as President Obama says, you know, you work above the company store. So you're always home. You're home for dinner a lot. So you all have experienced this, or you will anyway, the helping out when it comes to writing papers. So, you know, we're in the writing business. And so you might want to lend a hand every once in a while when you read something they write. But you guys may not do this, but you may also sometimes go overboard. And so it's like 2 hours later, you know, and they're in tears as you're just rounding around your assessment of the second paragraph. So you can imagine a president who's written two books and fancies himself a writer just being, you know, you wouldn't want to show dad anything that you've written. Look, you would have a lot of seriously meaningful conversations about how to stay like in touch with your own values because the whole world conspires to knock you off course, how to sort of keep yourself when all about them are losing their heads, which is not a bad conversation to have with your kids, but there aren't always the opportunities to do it. As president, you get a lot of those opportunities to talk to your kid about that, and also how to basically deal with when people do, you know, and are mean to you. You learn how to deal with that pretty quickly. So those are not bad lessons for kids to have.
So let's talk about you for a second, John.
Wait, Kim, before we talk about me, which is my favorite subject, and I appreciate it because you promised me we'd talk about me. So I was reading about Jimmy Carter for something else recently and reading his diary. So the diary's written, you know, personal, professional, personal, professional. So here he goes. I approved judges, and Mrs. Ginsburg wanted to be on the Second Circuit Court of the D.C. Court. She has been a matter of some controversy. That is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, now Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Next sentence. Amy had a dirty word written in her hand, and we deprived her of television entertainment and visitors for 3 days. She's a remarkably well-behaved child, doing really well on the violin, but doesn't like the lessons. With Republican congressional leaders, Jake Garn... So that was how Jimmy Carter parented.
Got it.
I'm sorry, back to me?
No. So you wrote a very beautiful piece after the last presidential election about coming back home to your family, to your kids, after having been on the campaign trail for... you know, 18 months, 2 years, You're preparing to do that again. How do you prepare for it? And what is that process like for your kids, for you, for your wife?
my long-suffering wife, who's here.
Yeah,
I'm here. Well, it's so they're older now, which is good and bad. The bad, of course, is you feel like they're slipping faster and faster and faster out of your cold grasp. No, but you know, you feel like those. It's different and changing, and they're changing much faster, and the distance that they separate from you feels faster than before. I mean, you go on the road for 2 weeks and you come back and they look taller and they have new words and they talk in ways that are really different. But now it's really big leaps. Like, you come back and they're shaving. What has been interesting and good about being on the road over the last few months, because it turns out I'm always on the road, two things have been interesting. One is you develop this epistolary relationship with the daughter or son who likes to write. So my daughter really is in, we exchange emails, and her voice in emails is a lot different than her regular voice, which is permanently mute. she just disappears from the, you know, so we don't, but when we communicate by email, it's really interesting, and you can have long exchanges that are different. My son is the exact opposite. So I'll get like a couple of letters arranged, sometimes into a word. but in person, he's much more, you know, he's much less laconic. What I've started to do recently that seems to sort of work, and actually the audience at our San Francisco Live Gabfest, all of them were so awesome in this. So I'll take a video. Skyping is a mess because they're from this generation where they don't know how to use phones, right? Because they just text. So they don't know how to, the phone rings and they put it like on their shoulder. And it's amazing.
My kid, once she calls someone on the phone and they answer the phone, she says, "Who is this?"
And why are you calling me? Yeah. So because they have no relationship with being tied to a phone with at least, I mean, you can pace, but in the old days where there was the curly cue, you had to at least participate in the mechanism of the right. phone. With Skype, you Skype and they're just bouncing all around. Like, they don't care. That's not. But if you if you send them a video, then they can watch it on their time and then they send one back. So we've been exchanging videos on our own time schedules, which works out pretty well. And it's cool. They get to see different hotel rooms. And I'm telling you, the Courtyard Marriott in Des Moines is so much different than the one in Dayton. So that's the way you try and deal with being on the road.
Sounds like a joy.
Yeah. But also, they're at the stage where they're like, a little goes a long way with their relationship with dad.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah, hey, dad. Okay, that's cool. Bye.
Plus, you have all those children who are going to be in the debate in a couple of weeks that you'll have to corral and deal with.
You mean you're referring to the candidates?
Oh,
are
yes.
You? Are you?
That was what I call political commentary.
Yeah. I was thinking you could have a little bleacher of children, and then at some key point you could say, "But what about the children?"
All right, thank you very much, John Dickerson. Give it up. All right, we've gotten to recommendations. Allison, why don't you take it away?
Okay, I want to recommend coin collecting for kids. My kids right now, you know, they go through phases of what they're into, but they're both into, or two of them that are old enough to be into things, are into football, which is kind of strange. We're not athletic at all, and I think, right, we're supposed to be discouraging football, but
it's
we just,
true.
Yeah, yeah, we just had a football birthday party, which, like, they wanted it to be tackle football, and everyone wears helmets, and I had to explain brain trauma to them. But then they're also into money, like very into money. Counting money, comparing money, everything money, obsessed with money. I have no idea how that happened because I don't care about money at all.
No, no.
But so we're slowly in the process of sort of trying to focus that interest in money into coin collecting. And I think it's working. It's like educational. It's fun. It's making them not turn into little Bernie Madoffs. So yeah, that's my recommendation. There are these fun books where you can, you know, you guys know what this is. You stick in the state quarters into every state and it takes them a good few hours to work on it. That's my recommendation. What is Dan's recommendation?
Okay, so my recommendation is these. I am busy working right now feverishly, even behind the scenes things are happening, on manufacturing and selling the game Ace of Hates and becoming a thousandaire. as heard on Slate's Mom and Dad Are Fighting. But so I was writing the rules the other day, and I got stuck on how to decide who goes first.
Wait, you really are doing this?
Yeah. My lawyer just finished the trademark search.
Really?
Yeah. You don't get a dime. So, like, it's hard to figure out who goes first in a game. Like, you can draw a card, everyone draws a card, but then there's so many ties, you have to draw other cards, and it's so boring. Or, like, some games have it, like, who had the most recent birthday, or who was the last person to poop? And those of you, like, have to talk it out, and what if you never poop? But so, I was trying to think of what, there should be a product that just allows you to figure out who goes first in a game every time, and it's perfectly even and equal, and no one has an advantage, and now there is such a product. It is these. They are Go First Dice. They're 12-sided dice. There's four of them, and they are mathematically created so that every time you roll all four of them, you never repeat a number, and they have an equal chance of coming up in any sequence. So everyone has an equal chance of going first in the game. Apparently, this is actually a very tricky mathematical calculation that mathematicians have been working on for years and years and years and years and years. And so so these mathematicians named, I think of them as mathemagicians, named Eric Harshbarger and Robert Ford figured out the calculation and designed these dice. They are such a great and elegant solution to a problem that you didn't even know you have. You can get them for £9 sterling from mathsgear.co.uk. We will have a link on our Facebook page. You can also read the whole mathematically complicated story of how they came to be at bit.ly.com/gofirstdice. We are going to use these Go First Dice to decide who buys me the first drink at the bar afterwards.
I don't want to shit on your recommendation,
but
I do not think that is going to take off just as much as Ace of Hates is going to take off. That's our show.
That's our show. That's our show. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting or drop us an email at momanddad@slate.com. Thanks so much to our producer, Ann Hepperman, and to Jocelyn Guest, who's recording us live today. Thanks to Andy Bowers, the Chief Content Officer for Panoply. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is part of the Panoply Network. To see the rest of our lineup of podcasts, visit itunes.com/panoply. Thanks to our guests, Stephen Thompson, John Dickerson, and Valerie Jarrett. Thank you to our intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. Thanks to Slate's Aaron Bergen and Faith Smith for making this show happen. And thanks to Woolly Mammoth for hosting us. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you to our amazing crowd here in D.C. Give yourselves a hand. Good night.